The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 28th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's program:
Iran has been using this time to advance its nuclear program in a variety of ways, including enriching uranium to 20% and even 60%, using more advanced centrifuges, acquiring more knowledge. And so that runway is getting shorter.
The United States has expressed concerns about Iran's weapons program, but is the prospect of fresh nuclear talks music to Washington's ears? Also, Ed.
Japan has consistently upheld values such as freedom, democracy, the rule of law, market-based economy, and fundamental human rights.
Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida makes his pitch to stay in office as the country's general election looms. Plus, the day's business headlines, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here with his weekly pop countdown as well. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. Iran's government has announced that it will return to talks that aim to revive the 2015 nuclear deal by the end of November. It's the first time that Tehran has set a date for the resumption of the long-delayed talks. Let's get the latest with Holly Dagres, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and curator of the Iranist newsletter. Good to speak with you, Holly. Welcome to the program. So what exactly has Iran said now?
Well, Iran, its lead nuclear negotiator tweeted that Iran would resume talks at the end of November. Now, we've heard Iran repeatedly said that sometime in October or November, they were going to resume talks. But for a while there, we weren't really sure where things were going. So this tweet kind of confirmed things. And he also added, that is the Deputy Foreign Minister, Ali Bagheri-Kani, that sometime at the end of this week, they will have an exact date for us as well.
Do you think something has changed behind the scenes now? Why has Iran decided to continue with these negotiations?
I don't think it's necessarily that things have changed behind the scenes. I think there's two things going on. For starters, I think Iran was slowing things down in part because the Joe Biden administration had done so as well. When Joe Biden took office in January, it took about till April for the United States to return to nuclear talks in Vienna, that is not directly with Iran, as the two countries were actually in separate meetings discussing the nuclear negotiations. So I think there was part of that. They were slowly dragging their feet on purpose. At the same time, there's also a board of governors meeting coming up in November, and that actually gives the remaining signatories of the JCPOA and other members of the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors to actually possibly rebuke Iran for its acceleration of its nuclear program. So I think there was some concern there that if that would happen, it would make it harder for Iran to return to negotiations, which they had actually threatened in the past.
So what would the status of those talks, those negotiations be now? How optimistic are you, for example, that something can be achieved?
Well, I think the easiest part is actually getting people to sit down and talk about things. Now, the real question here is what would come about. The rumor is that when the talks ceased in June after the selection of Ebrahim Raisi as president in the June election, there was this assumption that actually Iran and the United States had come to an agreement on some sort of compliance and compliance. Iran rolls back parts of its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. That was the rumor, and that's the theory right now. But we also aren't really sure. Have things changed? Do the Iranians want more? Does the U.S. want more? So I think we really won't know until this group sits down and talks again in November.
How keen is America, for example, to engage in these talks now?
Well, I think for the United States, this is somewhat a sore in their thigh. The Biden administration is very much focused on East Asia, and this is something that Biden's own administration under the Barack Obama administration when he was vice president had to deal with before. And so at that time, they had hoped that they had sorted things out. And with the Donald Trump administration coming in and withdrawing in May 2018 and reimposing sanctions, despite the fact Iran had not violated the deal, that became a big problem for not just the United States, but also for the remaining signatories. So I think they definitely would like to get this sorted out because it is worrisome for them that Iran's nuclear program is speeding up. And at the same time, they want to be able to focus on other things. And of course, the other, of course, is climate change, the pandemic, and the economy as well.
How much have we heard from Iran so far about what the country wants in order to accept the deal?
Well, Iran has repeatedly said that it wants sanctions removal. We've also heard them that they want their $10 billion in frozen assets unfrozen before they would sit down and talk. So we've been hearing different things, but at the end of the day, the key here is for them to have the ability to sell their oil and do international banking. So that is a priority because that has hurt their economy. The country is in a dire state, not just because of mismanagement, corruption, and the pandemic, but of course because of U.S. sanctions as well.
Do you think Iran could one day rejoin the deal?
I think there's always hope. I'm a firm believer in diplomacy. It's just a matter of will on both sides, whether they can come to a compromise. I think when it comes to diplomacy, nobody's going to ever be happy with an outcome, and that's when a deal actually works. And I think this is exactly what happened with the 2015 nuclear agreement.
And just finally, Holly, what are going to be the next steps now? What's happening first?
Well, the next steps is that they set a date. So we're hoping an exact date at the end of November and that these remaining signatories to the Iran nuclear agreement meet in Vienna to discuss things and maybe take things off from where they left off in June. So that seems to be the way forward for now.
Thank you very much, Polly. That was Holly Dagres from the Atlantic Council. And now here is Monocle's Emma Searle with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. A leading US general has said that China's hypersonic missile test is close to a Sputnik moment, referring to the Soviet satellite launch that sparked the Cold War arms race. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, also told Bloomberg News that the Chinese military was expanding rapidly. The Vatican says Pope Francis has agreed to visit Canada to assist with an ongoing reconciliation effort with Indigenous groups. It follows reports that many Indigenous children died while attending residential schools. The Catholic Church played a pivotal role in the school's founding and operation. New Zealand is expected to ease pandemic-induced border restrictions, which have been in place since March 2020, and move to a system of home isolation for fully vaccinated visitors. It follows the government's announcement that strict lockdown measures will end when 90% of its eligible population is fully vaccinated. And the luxury fashion brand, Jean Paul Gaultier, has launched its own rental service. The first 50 items, which will be rotated on loan from its 30,000-piece archive, include icons from the 1980s and 1990s, such as the conical brassiere made famous by Madonna. For more, head to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Marcus.
Thank you very much, Emma. A new opinion poll suggests Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party could lose its parliamentary majority in Sunday's general election. However, Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and his LDP party look set to retain power thanks to a long-standing political pact with a junior coalition partner. Sir David Warren joins me now. He was the UK's ambassador in Japan between 2008 and 2012. Welcome to Monocle 24. So what are the polls in Japan telling us?
Well, I think that they're telling us that the Liberal Democratic Party, which has governed Japan for most of the post-war period, is likely to lose some seats. It has 276 in the lower house, the House of Representatives, and it's going to lose some of those. But the most recent Kyodo poll that I've seen indicates that it will retain enough seats to be able to control the standing committees of the lower house and push through its legislative program. They'll do that in coalition, of course, with the smaller Kōmeitō party. They've been in coalition with the Kōmeitō for many years. Both parties have powerful voting machines and will get the electoral vote out on Sunday. Of course, behind this lies quite a lot of disaffection from ordinary Japanese voters from party politics generally. Recently, prime ministers have won elections in Japan on relatively small votes. Prime Minister Abe was sustained in power for nearly a decade on very small turnouts in relative terms. So I would suspect that the LDP will still be in power next week, with a slightly reduced majority and on the basis of a lowish vote.
Can you tell us more about how the Japanese public feels about this election? What are the factors contributing to the lack of excitement?
Well, after a period of considerable political stability under Shinzo Abe, Japanese politics has reverted to the revolving door of Japanese prime ministers. Abe's successor, Yoshihide Suga, lasted only 12 months in the job before he had to stand down. His successor, Fumio Kishida, who is an experienced and reliable centrist politician, comes into office with only a modest bounce of post-election popularity. His popularity rating was a little lower than Suga's 12 months ago. So he's entering the election on a mandate which, to a degree, turns its back on Abenomics and seeks to emphasize inequality and I suppose, as we would say in Britain, leveling up in Japanese terms, coupled with a strong defense stance towards China. But his personality is not tremendously strong. His centrist views, of course, run the risk of being attacked from both sides. He doesn't seem to be engendering the sort of further that political leaders would like to see at this stage of an electoral cycle. And there is, in any case, I think in Japan, a tendency to get a little tired of constant elections and politicians constantly seeking some sort of endorsement of their mandate. So there's a degree of apathy, but that shouldn't lead us to underestimate the effectiveness of the party machines and the desire for the Japanese voter for a degree of stability. So it means, I think, in my view, that the opposition parties who are trying to operate as a coalition themselves, both the Constitutional Democratic Party and the Japan Communist Party, trying to compete with the LDP by joining up in key constituencies, they're going to have difficulty, I think, doing much more than flipping some of the vote in the urban areas.
What do you think have been the most interesting election pledges you've heard so far? How much have we heard, for example, from the LDP party?
Well, we've heard a great deal from Kishida because he attaches a lot of importance to getting his message across and establishing himself and as the new man on the block. And he's emphasized a break with Abenomics. He's emphasized a degree of spending for a post-COVID society. He will present the success of the LDP, if that is what happens, in next week's election as an endorsement of its management of the COVID crisis. And he will also present it as an endorsement of his economic policy to reverse trends towards inequality within Japan, and particularly within the Japanese regions. At the same time, and he comes into the office as a little bit more of a dove than some of his predecessors, he will want to emphasize Japan's alliance with the United States and its determination to resist aggression by its neighbor, China. So getting that balance between an economic policy that serves the whole of society and a national defense stance that asserts Japan's reliance upon the United States and determination to stand up to China, he's hoping we'll see him through to victory.
What's also interesting in Japan is that many young people actually do not vote. How much have the parties done over there to try to attract young voters in particular?
Well, the parties have tried to embrace young voters through social media and many other forms. And one of the interesting developments in recent years was the extent to which young voters were supporting the more conservative parties. So if the young voters are turning away from politics in Japan, as they are in a number of countries, that's bad for all parties, and it may be particularly bad for the LDP. I've seen in some polls that there is some speculation that the right-wing Ishin no Kai, which is a nationalist party and has 11 seats but tends to be confined to the Kansai, the region of western Japan, might increase its representation. At the moment, it seems difficult, really, to get voters, including young voters, focused on the election to a degree that is going to lead us to make very confident judgments. But we are seeing a degree of young voter apathy in Japan as we are elsewhere.
And just finally, what kind of challenges will the new government face after the election? Will the ongoing pandemic and economic rebalancing suck all the energy?
Well, the pandemic appears to be working its course in Japan. The level of cases has fallen to a very, very low level in recent days, and that is seen as a success of the government's strategy and a success of a vaccine rollout, which started very slowly but picked up speed very impressively. Of course, Japan will face the problems that the rest of the world faces in terms of the global economy returning to full activity in the wake of the pandemic, and it will face particular defense and security problems in the Asia-Pacific region as the world and the developed world in particular adapts to its stance of what President Biden has described as strategic competition with China. That's difficult for Japan because although Japan is threatened by China in one sense, it depends upon the Chinese economy as an crucial economic, commercial, and industrial partner in another. So there's a conflict there for Japanese politicians to manage. There's also a lot of unresolved business with Japan's other neighbor in Korea, where relations have been markedly cool and not so far warmed up by the arrival of Prime Minister Kishida.
David, thank you very much for your insights. That was the UK's former ambassador to Japan, Sir David Warren, and you're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, we are hearing from Aya Khalil, global head of the AI Innovation Center at Novartis. How is Novartis using AI to find new molecules? What are the actual mechanics of that presumably very complex process?
Discovering a new molecule, it's what we like to call a multi-objective optimization problem. There's many things we have to optimize towards to be able to find a compound with the right characteristics in terms of its efficacy, in terms of its safety. And so the design process of a small molecule is something where a medicinal chemist is faced with this complexity and trying to optimize around it. And so what we're trying to do is enable the chemist essentially to, in silico on the computer, search through a massive space of possibilities, a massive place of drug-like molecules, something that could be as vast as 10 to the 60 molecules, right? So we're talking trillions and trillions and trillions of possibilities, and using the computer to help you find and optimize towards the right properties, and also augment the thinking of the analyst. And in doing so, we're aiming to essentially increase the success rate of our drug discovery and get to first-in-class medicines faster. We've developed an AI engine, an AI platform that uses deep learning to create a massive virtual chemical space. And then within the space, the AI engine maps out what those potential candidates could be and enables the medicinal chemist, hopefully, to find molecules with the right characteristics around solubility, binding affinity, the right chemical properties, and select and design those molecules faster.
Aya Khalil, Global Head of the AI Innovation Center at Novartis. An enduring commitment for more than a quarter of a century. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
And you are back with a briefing on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. Let's get a quick update on the day's main business news now with Bloomberg's Euan Potts. Thanks for joining us as always, Euan. Shall we start with some good news for change on energy prices?
Yeah, Russia's President Putin has ordered Gazprom, the state energy giant, to begin filling European storage sites from early November. It's a bit of very welcome news for Europe's gas market. You remember that a lot of energy prices hit record highs, massive record highs earlier this month. Well, gas, the benchmark natural gas price in Europe dropped as much as 12% today on the news that Russia is to start pumping. Russia's plan is that once it's filled its own storage, it will begin pumping from November the 8th. According to the Russian president. It's also plans to fill up the sites in the European Union. It's been a big concern for energy markets. So we've gone into the heating season with gas inventories at their lowest level in more than a decade. We had that bitter winter last year, which really saw supplies reduce. Also, a lot of competition for LNG, liquefied natural gas, from Asia, those being diverted to the other side of the world. So we hoping see these gas prices continue to fall. Also good news from higher flows from Norway's gas fields and also a drop in Chinese coal prices, which is also helping on the energy story.
Could you then bring us up to date with how the microchip shortage is affecting the car industry?
Yeah, I've heard from two of Europe's biggest car makers today. You remember that the car industry has really been roiled by this shortage of microchips. It's been affecting production massively. The headline figures not so good, really, from these automakers. Europe's biggest car maker, Volkswagen, seeing third quarter operating profit drop by 12%. Stellantis, the big company formed by the merger of Peugeot, Citroën and Fiat Chrysler, saw revenue dropping 14%. It's lost output of around 600,000 cars over the period. But both companies saying they think the worst of the chip shortage is probably over. Herbert Diess, the boss of Volkswagen, telling Bloomberg that he reckons by the end of the year there will still be a half a million car backlog in the VW order book. So they've got a lot of stuff to make up. Chips are still coming very, very slowly, but one important measure of how bad the chip crisis is seems to be improving. The latest data in October shows that the gap between ordering a semiconductor and when it's delivered is now about 22 weeks. It's still increasing, but only very, very slowly. It had been rising very fast over the course of this year. So it sounds like at least the car makers think the chip crisis is at least there's some end in sight to that.
And finally today, Euan, the debate around the future of the high street in the UK continues. Now IKEA says it's opening a huge store in the heart of London. What can you tell us?
Yeah, the address 214 Oxford Street. Doesn't sound very fancy, does it? But it is a seven-storey building at the junction of Oxford Street and Regent Street, right in the centre of London's West End. The purchase price for this little property, almost, in fact, over half $1 billion, £378 million. It's being sold by, it was a former building occupied by Topshop and Top Man, a great place to buy clothes. It was an enormous clothes empire. But of course, with the end of Top Man, Philip Green's Arcadia Group disbanding. The shop closed down. Bit of a shame if you like to buy some bit of fashion. But it's now being bought by IKEA. The managing director of Ingkar Investments, which is the property section of IKEA, says that securing ownership of properties in prime locations instead of leasing will preserve value on a long-term basis. So it's quite a vote of confidence in London's retail market, and perhaps surprising if you think that so much is moving online, but perhaps IKEA is a business which doesn't really work online. Traditionally, it's focused, of course, on those big out-of-town stores which you need to drive to. Many people, many prosperous customers in London don't have cars, so IKEA is trying to change its strategy to open up some city centre stores. So they're splashing $500 million on this prime spot right in the middle of London.
Major news for Oxford Street, indeed. Bloomberg's Euan Potts, thank you very much for joining us today. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally today, we continue with one of our regular features here on The Briefing. It's time for Global Countdown. Fernando Augusto-Pacheco joins me in the studio. Good afternoon to you. How are you doing today?
Very good, Marcus. And you're going to be happy because I chose a music market that I've heard that apparently you're quite interested.
So we're going to Finland?
Not quite. We're going to Russia, actually. And I always love going to Russia because...
Have you actually been in Russia?
Never been there, but I did explore their music charts. They love up-tempo music. But I don't want to contradict myself, Marcus, because funnily enough, number five is actually the opposite of up-tempo. It's actually a heartbreaking ballad and very sad lyrics, which I will translate to you after. But shall we listen to the clip? Number five, it's Sultan Lagochev with Bitter Taste.
Никогда меня прошу, не вспоминай, я горький вкус твоей любви меня убил, теперь без сил, а ты змея пустила яд, любовный яд, да я так рад, что все прошло, а может.
So a bit of Russian gloominess there. It wasn't quite as downbeat as I was expecting, Fernando.
Yes, but the lyrics, look at that, Marcus. Don't tell me about love, which is not in your heart, and don't call me yours. You crossed my boundaries. I mean, he's very sad, actually.
Do you think it's something, do you see connections between Russian culture, maybe your culture, dare I say, in terms of this, all the drama in relationships and all that we heard over there?
I think so. You know what? And the Russians, Marcus, they love Brazilian telenovelas. So clearly we both have a passion for drama.
Excellent. Let's continue then, Fernando. What's number four in the Russian charts this week?
Something a bit more contemporary. She's a Russian rapper and a former blogger as well, according to her biography. You know, remember the times of blogging, Marcus? It's a good time.
I'm amazed by how people's CVs are changing nowadays. All the stuff you can put in there. Do you like this song, by the way?
Number four... It's interesting. I'm not going to say I love it, but it's quite fun. And she has quite a scandalous kind of a social media outlook. She wears like very interesting clothes, and the lyrics are the opposite of
gloomy.
What
do you mean by interesting clothes?
Well, I mean, it's very colorful. She wants to shock. She wants to kind of break boundaries in a way.
Like you in the office.
Exactly, exactly. But let's have a listen. This is Instasanka with Lipsy Ha.
So, Fernando, if we play this song at Monaco's Christmas party, will we see you twerking on the dance floor?
Maybe not quite. I mean, maybe her social media presence is better than her music. And Marcus, I'm sorry, we can't get enough of Instasanka because she's also number three.
What's going on?
With another song called Juicy. Let's
Juicy,
have a listen.
Okay. Моя шапка на торсе, мои доллары в плюсе. Мне короты на уши, на мне дорого босса. Пусть и джисси на тусе, кучи мами на джисси. Джисси, джисси, деньги, деньги, мами, мами, туси, джисси. Моя шапка на торсе, мои доллары в плюсе. Мне короты на уши, на мне дорого босса. Мой рэп, телефон, на балансе триллион. Кучи и витон, о, мой рацион. Как кажется, бэй, 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 миллион, это он. Я рэп, это лон. Two beautiful songs there from the same artist, Fernando.
She's going to be touring all over Russia. It's Instasanka, if you're interested.
Instasanka.
Maybe you should start following her. She has more than 5 million followers,
Is she like the Mariah Carey of Russia?
Not Mariah Carey. I think more like a Doja Cat.
I was thinking of Nicki Minaj for some reason. Fernando, which one did you prefer?
I think Lipsy Ha, perhaps.
Lipsy Ha.
Lipsy Ha. I mean, to be honest with you, Marcus, I think let's go to the good stuff. I think number two is quite an interesting track as well.
Okay.
And it's been in the charts for months and months.
Is it Russian as well?
It's Russian. I think they like their own acts there. It's a duo, Galibri and Mavic. And the interesting thing, the name of the track is Federico Fellini. And I couldn't really find out. All I can say, I think they both love the very famous and iconic Italian director. And this is a song, it's definitely upbeat, something for the dance floor, and maybe not as sweary as Instasanka.
Let's have a listen. Оскарев ти богиня, словно кукла Барби на витрине хочет главную роль в картине. Я как Федерико Феллини, дайте Оскарев ти богиня, словно кукла Барби на витрине хочет главную. Well, this song by Galibri and Mavic, it actually reminds me of my travels in Russia years ago. I always feel like this kind of music was playing there in the background when I was there with my friends drinking vodka.
Good times, right, Marcus? I think it's an excellent track, and I understand why Russians love it. And if any Russian listeners are listening at the moment, tell me why Federico Fellini, do they love it? Or is it kind of an internal expression in Russia? Maybe it means something else. I love Federico Fellini, I have to say.
Me too. Well, Fernando, already it's time to reveal what is topping the charts in Russia this time round. Do you first want to tell us if you approve of that song?
Very much approve. I think it's a blockbuster of a song. Again, it's been a few months, so I think both Federico Fellini and our number one song, you know, they just stick around because they're good. You know, I think people love it. They're listening multiple times. It's by Khabib there with Raspberry, another very catchy track from the former police officer.
Yes, I think I like it. I also like how it always seems relevant in Russian singles charts what these artists have done before. So Khabib wasn't a former blogger. Instead, he was a former police officer. I wonder what happened.
In fact, I have to correct myself. Also a criminologist.
Oh.
So he's got a lot of talents, this man. And the song is very good. 309 million views on YouTube as well. That's a massive number. And not only in Russia, but I think even in the neighboring countries, the song has been a big hit as well. No, it didn't reach the UK for some reason.
It's a big market, nevertheless. It's maybe a bit insular. Maybe it's hard to break around the world if you perform in Russian. Do you think these songs would have potential to actually turn into global hits if someone... First of all, do they need to be translated into English?
Yes. I mean, for example, but you see with Instasanka, clearly she uses a little bit of English in her songs, as we could hear in one of the tracks. But I think the Galibri song, Federico Fellini, I mean, I'm sure it could have been a worldwide hit. It's so fun and interesting. Even the title of the song is interesting. Overall, I like it.
Me too. Thank you very much, Fernando, for joining us today on The Briefing. And that's all for today's programme. It was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our researcher was Lillian Fawcett and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. That's at 1400 if you're listening in Moscow, midday in London, 7 a.m. in Washington, D.C. I am Marcus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening.